Before we get started, I'd like to set the context for why we're here. And I'd like you all to think of a number that represents how fast climate zones are moving from south to north. Now, we all know that things are getting warmer as we go forward in time. And that means that isotherms, lines of equal temperature, are moving northward in our hemisphere, in our northern hemisphere. How fast do you think those isotherms are moving northward? Now, you're going to take a number between 0 and 100, and I have to give you some units. And the units are meters, about a yard, meters per reunion weekend. All right, so we're here for around 3 days. So how far are climate zones moving northward in the northern hemisphere during the 3 days of our reunion? You got about 5 seconds to come up with a number. Okay, now, does everybody have a number? All right, now I want you to turn to the person next to you and share that number. Your number may go up or down, may stay the same, depends. All right, so let's see how we came out. How many people think that the climate is moving north between 0 and 1 meter in the time that we're at reunion? Hands high. Okay. How about 1 to 5? All right. 5 to 10. So 10 meters is roughly 10 yards on a football field. Okay. 10 to 30. 30 to 50. 50 to 100. Okay, so it's maybe a little bit of a bell-shaped curve there. Most of you seem to gravitate towards a number somewhere between zero, in the middle, between 0 and 100. So let's roll out the answer now. This is where we begin the audience participation of our program. So I need about 5 volunteers. So a couple people. Paul, you can be first. A couple more people. It's easy. All right. So we need a few more people, and you're gonna slowly walk this down. Paul, you're gonna come over here. We need a couple more people. Don't just stop for a minute. Okay. So this caution tape represents the distance that climate zones are moving during the 3 days of our reunion. So just stand there. Move this down. Every 5 to 6 feet, we want another person coming up here. So we're gonna need some more people. So just hold this up like that. Yeah. Okay. Come on. Okay. As Brian here goes farther, just more people. We need more people to come down. Hold on. All right. So that's the answer. It's about 30 meters. 10 meters per day. That's how fast the climate is moving northward. Now, do the math. 10 meters a day times 365 days per year, that's about roughly 3.5 kilometers per year. Multiply that by a century, and you have about 350 kilometers per century, which is about 200 miles, which is the distance from Washington, D.C. to Amherst, Massachusetts, going north. So think about that. Now, my uncle, born in 1919, just 100 years ago, he was Amherst class of 1940, managing editor of The Student, by the way. He is now no longer with us, but within the space of less than 2 full generations, so from his birth year, and I've still got a few more years left, I hope, climate zones have moved 200 miles, 350 kilometers, to the north. So think about that. What's it going to be in another 100 years? We're going to have the climate that's now in Washington, D.C. will be indicative of Amherst, Massachusetts. So thank you very much for your participation. Let's give a big hand to our volunteers. You can just set that on the floor. You can just set it down. And you can take your seats.
Have a question? Is it an education useful to ask what the error bar is?
Yes. Absolutely. So, with that as context, I would like to now turn it over to Paul Stern, class of 64. Thank you.
Okay, and this is the clicker. Yeah. Okay, I'm talking about climate change as a liberal arts challenge. I have a lot more to say than I can cover in 5 minutes, and I did make a number of copies of a two-pager back-to-back thing that you can pick up at the back of the room at the end of the hour if you're interested. I see climate change as a top liberal arts challenge of the century. And, okay, that's just a cover sheet. First thing I want to say is to advertise that there are a number of activities going on at the reunion that relate to climate change in many ways. As it says, people can lead in dealing with climate change in many roles. This session is about the role as educators, parents, teachers, and so forth. People can lead in their roles as citizens, and there's a session at 4 o'clock today at Kirby that deals with that. People can lead in their roles within public and private sector organizations where they have some influence. There is a session tomorrow about what Amherst College is doing to achieve carbon neutrality, and that's partly a product of individuals working within the organization and trying to influence the organization. There is a session tomorrow on what people can do as investors by investing in companies that are doing good things for climate change and disinvesting in ones that aren't. And there are a number of other roles. People can invent technologies. There's an exhibit out on the Amherst Town Common organized by one of my classmates, Jerry Northrup, about a way to turn food waste into good fish to eat and other useful products. It's a brainchild of his. And there are other things that you can do. You can make change as consumers. You can make change as members of informal communities, neighborhoods, churches, and so forth. Moving on from that, it's important to recognize, as Charlie was pointing out, that the challenge of dealing with climate change is going to be with us for generations, no matter what we do now. These processes have long time lags. Even if we stopped net carbon emissions or greenhouse gas CO2 equivalent emissions tomorrow, we would be dealing with this for generations. So the next generation of leaders will need to, especially on the side of limiting climate change, and you've got to emphasize, the more of it we do and the faster we do it, the better off future generations will be. The next generation of leaders needs to consider and evaluate all kinds of proposed initiatives, from new technologies to public policies to economic interventions to communications and so forth, trying to focus first on the most promising ones and figuring out which the most promising ones are. Consider many types of initiatives using many intellectual tools. And the practical issues that people who work in this field even don't consider all of usually, one of them is the technical potential, which means if you create a new technology or a new process, if every target individual and organization for that actually adopted it, how much difference would it make? That's the technical potential. The practical feasibility includes, can you get the thing adopted? If it's a public policy, can you get it through Congress? Can you get it through agencies at the state and local government, the same kinds of issues? And if you do get it through, will it be implemented as intended? Will the target actors be able to evade the regulations, get around the economic incentives, find some way out of it? So this is practical feasibility. And then the third issue is behavioral plasticity. How much can the targets of these initiatives actually change, and how fast? And that all depends on aspects of the context in which they operate, so that the same public policy might be more effective in one country than another. If you incentivize using public transportation, it's more effective in tightly connected communities than it is in suburbs and rural areas, and so forth. Anyway, all those things need to be considered by the next generation in order to figure out what's worth doing. And that's why I say this poses the greatest liberal arts challenge of the 21st century. It requires integrating the physical and biological sciences and engineering to devise and perfect new technologies. It requires engaging economics and political science to design and perfect public policies, figure out what's politically feasible, what's socially feasible. It includes involving the non-economic and social and behavioral and cognitive sciences, which are the fields that I come out from and which I think are most commonly neglected in the science of how do you change society, how do you get people to change their behavior, which behaviors matter. Do the same influences matter for the behaviors that have high technical potential as for the behaviors that have low technical potential but are easily visible? You know, we have all this recycling stuff at Valentine Hall, and it's nice that people do it, but it's not as big a deal as some other things, and you want to make sure you change the big things as well as the little things. So these fields are useful for designing and perfecting information. How do you inform people in a way that they will take advantage of? How do you get people's attention to things that they're not paying attention to? And the humanities and arts need to be involved as well, because there are issues of value, there are issues of human needs and wants. You know, people think they need things, do they really need things? You know, and how do you think about that? How do you design public debate about policy, which is, you know, an issue in the social sciences and in the humanities and arts. And so, you know, all of those things are relevant, and all of them are needed. Do I have more to say? How can Amherst contribute? You know, I mean, this is a discussion for after I'm finished talking, except for, you know, the one thing that I want to say is to, you know, put in a plug for more engagement of the social sciences on the issue of limiting climate change, you know, in the Amherst curriculum and the Amherst process. I haven't seen enough of it in looking at the environmental studies program. Amherst is not alone. And I spent most of my career trying to make this case at the National Academy of Sciences, you know, with a little bit of success, but people don't all pick up on it. I mean, what more is there to say? There's more to say, but I'm out of time.
Thank you, Paul, and I think you set me up nicely for success here, so I appreciate it. Hi, everybody. I'm Laura Drocker. I'm the Director of Sustainability here at Amherst College, and I'm just going to go very briefly over the Climate Action Plan, focused really on my office, the Office of Environmental Sustainability, and the Climate Action Plan and how that relates to education. So in a nutshell, and I didn't realize this was going to be so small, I apologize. Our Climate Action Plan integrates timely and innovative energy system decarbonization with experiential learning opportunities to take Amherst College beyond carbon neutral by 2030. So there's two key pillars to this plan. The first is transitioning our campus energy infrastructure. We know we need to move away from our traditional fossil fuel-powered steam system to a renewably energy-powered heat pump system that uses geothermal energy sources. But the other piece is preparing our graduates to lead with innovative and diverse opportunities for our students to explore research and problem solve around climate change throughout the curriculum. And so I'm actually not going to speak at all right now about the technical piece, but tomorrow morning at 10:15 in Johnson Chapel, I'll be presenting with Jim Brassard. There's also the whole plan is on the web. If you just Google or search in the website for the Climate Action Plan, you can see it there. You, of course, are welcome to email me after this, and we can talk more. And I'll have a sign-up sheet available if you want us to send you a printed version of the plan. We can do that, too. But I'm going to focus now on the pillar around education, because that's the focus of this talk. And why do we incorporate education so strongly in our climate action plan? Well, really, the bottom line is that we know it's our moral obligation to run our campus without the use of fossil fuels into the future. We are committed to becoming carbon neutral, and that's going to be a big step for us as a college to address the climate crisis. But we also know that we're a small campus. We have a small footprint, relatively speaking. And so by us going carbon neutral, it's not really going to have a drop in the bucket, technically, on greenhouse gas emissions. But what we also know, and what all of you are well aware of, is that alumni of Amherst College have an oversized impact on the world. And we think that we really need to harness that for our full potential to address climate change. So to Paul's point, we really need to really have a huge impact on climate change, we need to make sure our graduates are equipped to lead on climate action through a range of things, through technology, through policy, through activism, education, investment, et cetera. And so how can we use the fact that the college is committed to becoming carbon neutral to also support students that are currently at school to be able to take this with them as they leave? This is something, although the Climate Action Plan was just approved in January, my office has been here since late 2014, and we've been doing a lot of work to try to engage students co-curricularly and curricularly on climate change above what is already lots of great work that's happening in the geology department, environmental studies, anthropology, sociology, et cetera. And some of the ways that we do that is engaging with faculty and curricular enhancements. We do research internships, other things in the Office of Sustainability. We partner and collaborate with our peer institutions. And we provide opportunities for students through student group engagement and other ways to really help show that climate action isn't only in the classroom, but it's everywhere. So now that we've got the Climate Action Plan passed, we're going to be just building on existing successes. So these are just a few examples of some of the things that we've done. Last summer, we had an intern from Amherst. This is Maya in the middle. She partnered up with an intern from Smith and Williams to do a joint summer project, taking the Project Drawdown model. Are people familiar with Project Drawdown? A few? So this is a really interesting book. It is 100 solutions to climate change, sort of ranked by their global impact. And we could probably debate whether they've got the numbers right, but I think what it does do is it gives a really clear picture of some of the areas of focus. Renewables, of course, things that we know, but there's also things like food and food waste, gender equality, and other things that rise to the top that we may not think of immediately when we think of climate change solutions. So these students took that book and then applied a higher ed lens to it. What should we, as higher ed institutions in New England, be doing related to this list of global priorities? One of the most enjoyable things I did this year was I took students with Emily Griffin and the Loeb Center to Boston. We met with alumni and other people that work in climate on a range of industries, people that are in foundations, Conservation Law Foundation, Union of Concerned Scientists, corporations. This was a picture of a young alum who works at the Municipal Planning Association. Students have done things about changing behavior in their classrooms. So this is a electronics for non-majors class that Professor Carter taught this year. And these students worked with me to help develop a shower timer that their peers could use to limit their hot water usage. And we take first-year students on a trip every beginning of their orientation program, and this is us touring an anaerobic digester in Hadley. So these are some of the things we've done. We've been able to take students to the Paris Climate Conference. We are just kind of always trying to think of different ways to bring climate change and use campus as a living lab. So what are some things we're going to do with the Climate Action Plan specifically? You know, we're going to look at temperature data and soil samples from the geothermal wells on the very technical side. On the other end of the spectrum, I would love to see us support creative expressions around the Climate Action Plan. explore the project from a different lens, an art exhibit, a film series, analyzing policy mechanisms and their roles for a just energy transition, partnering with our on-campus farm, which if you haven't heard about, you should definitely check out. I'm biased because it's part of the Office of Sustainability, but I think it's a wonderful part of the college. And one thing I'm really interested in doing is having our students really engage in the Climate Action Plan implementation and report that information back out to the whole community, which includes all of you. So we're thinking maybe we might do a webinar or something where a student that works on the CAP can explain what progress we've been making over the year, for example. So just to end, I want to share one example because I think this really highlights how scalable some of the work that our students are doing can be if given the right tools. So just this November, there was a student group that was really advocating for us to pass the Climate Action Plan, and they pulled together 10 of their peers from various backgrounds to share their personal experiences with climate change and environmental injustice at an event that they held in the library. They were able to coordinate with Biddy's schedule so she could attend. Over 200 people attended, which for an event late in November is really, really amazing. It was very, very powerful. But they didn't stop there. A student who just graduated, Anna Dalton, she created a video of the event for a class project, but was able to circulate that around and really create even more lasting impact from the event. If you go to YouTube and you Google Amherst College Students for Climate Action, it should pop up. It's about 7 minutes. It's really worthwhile. But taking it a step further, with my help, some of the students submitted a proposal to present kind of how they went around influencing organizational action on climate change, and they were accepted. So I'm hoping to be able to take them to an upcoming conference that the Association for Advancement of Higher Sustainability in Higher Education Conference and give them the opportunity to present their work to their peers. We're hoping to do even more of this. So I'm glad I got the opportunity to talk to you about it. I'm going to turn it over to Anna, who can talk even more about.
I'm trying to wrap my head around the fact that you've been here since, it's 2014?
Yeah,
I remember I was on the committee that was looking, hiring that sustainability position, and I can't believe time seems to just go by without me really noticing it. Now, I was going to start by talking about what both geology and environmental studies has in the way of curricular development, et cetera, but something struck me when Charlie was doing this very good demonstration at the beginning of this talk. And he's wheeling that out, and he was saying, oh, how fast do the isotherms go north? And I don't know if you guys noticed, but I went on my iPhone for a second, which is something that I usually rip it out of my students' hands when they dare to go on an iPhone when I'm talking. But I had to look that up because I was just like, well, you know, what isotherms are you talking about them moving all sequentially at the same rate? But the ones that are further north are moving much faster than the ones that are closer to the equator. And all of a sudden, I got bogged down in what scientists always get bogged down in. What are the error bars? What exactly are we talking about? How do we make, you know, how do I put in all of the information into something that, on the other hand, was visually and intrinsically just a much better way to evidence the fact that climate change is all around us? I also, for those of you who have not read either the magazine, the article or the book, The Uninhabitable Earth, by David Wallace, I highly recommend you do that. I did that about a month ago. It is a superb, it's an easy read in terms of it. It's written very journalistic style, but it is a moment where you realize what the impact is that is already here with us, that we're living with every day. And I've been sort of a part of this climate world for a long time. This is my 20th year here at Amherst College, and I came here as an environmental scientist in the geology department. At that time, there was no environmental studies. And so in the geology department, most of my work has been on hydrogeology, but I also taught an introduction to climate science because that was something that even back then in 1999, students were very interested in. And at an introductory level, even though I'm not personally a climate scientist per se, it was a course that I helped develop here. We didn't get environmental studies here as a major until the mid-2000s under the guiding influence of Jan Dezard, who many of you probably know. And without him, it might have taken a whole number of years more before that actually happened. And we didn't become a department until, well, relatively few years ago. We have our first full-time faculty member in environmental studies is coming up for his third year review. So this is a very young department at a very old institution. And I think that gives us a lot of ways to grow in the future. And one way in particular that I want to say to you, especially in the context of this discussion, is that we just got approval this last year amongst the always tight fight for FTEs, but we just got approval to hire and hire in the realm of climate science with tendrils definitely going into the social sciences as well and the humanities, which I think environmental studies as a major, as an interdisciplinary by nature major here, tries to do all the time. So when you look at the curricula right now in terms of climate science or climate, I take full responsibility in part for it being not what I would hope it to be, with this being such a critical issue of the times. It is in development, and we have some very good people here in different departments that teach to it, in economics department with Kate Sims, and across some of the other departments here. But it is developing, and we hope to soon have our second member, a full-time FTE member of the Environmental Studies Department very, very shortly. But the greater issue here that we want to hear from you guys about as well is sort of what does the liberal arts in terms bring to, what is the educational role that we play in developing both our students here, but in looking outward into the community and looking forward. And I would have to say that in terms of just the pure science of climate change, there's very few doubters out there. Right? In my classes, and I've taught classes with a cap of 60 year after year, it is rare that the science is not particularly well understood or will be shortly after I get through with them. So that is not usually the issue. The issue are these other things that Paul talked about a lot, is bringing that sort of understanding of what actually is happening all around us and then moving it into action. One of the things that I also have to, once again, tip my hat to Jan Dezard for starting here is a program that he started in January, interterm, where it was a week-long course in activism, in building political activism in students. He ran it. We had students from Smith. We had students from Mount Holyoke. But it was a very well-received course by the participants, and sort of building in that sort of knowledge of how to do political, I'm going to use the term again, activism, how to do it and do it well. Because that is something that we have to take beyond the classroom. And certainly, once again, as a scientist, I don't always do it as well as my colleagues do. And so with that, shall we bring it?
Thank you very much, Anna. Okay, so I would like to finish up with a few notes about the role of early and informal education. So at the college level, we're talking about students typically 18 to 22, plus or minus a few years. But most of my career has been spent with children. And this is the Science Center, a hands-on interactive science museum that I helped get off the ground about 30 years ago in Ithaca. We had many Amherst graduates working on this, by the way. Bill Weary, class of 64, was an advisor to us. Bill Bassett, class of 54, Bassett Planetarium. He was one of the original board members. This organization got me thinking about the role of setting the foundation for learning that happens in the older ages. And one of my favorite quotes of Einstein's is this one: no problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it. And to me, this means that we need to start much earlier than college in order to develop the kinds of brains that are going to attack this problem. It happens a lot earlier in life. And so I've become very interested in the last few years now. I moved my faculty appointment at Cornell from civil engineering to human development, and I'm working in early childhood now because of this, and looking at how we can develop children from the earliest ages that will have the kind of values that will lead them to do the kinds of things that we're talking about at Amherst College when they're older. So this is just a group of children at the Ithaca Forest Preschool, where they spend all their time outdoors. 90% of their time is spent outdoors in preschool. So here's a question for you. When does a human brain reach 80% of its adult mass? Is it A, 3 years, beginning of preschool, B, 11 years, the beginning of middle school, or C, 18 years, the beginning of college? How many think A? How many think B? C. Okay, the A's have it. So 80% of the adult brain mass is developed by age 3. So here's a couple of milestones about childhood that may be of interest. So at birth, a child can begin to detect light and a little bit of motion when they're born, in the first week. By 1 month, they're able to recognize faces at about 300 millimeters. That's about a foot, size of a basketball. Kids are walking at the first year. That's an amazing thing. Second year, they're able to talk. Third year, knowledge is 50% complete. Now, think about that. At 3 years old, a child knows 50% of what it will know as an adult. It knows about gravity, it knows who to trust, it knows all kinds of things. So a lot of things happen in those first few years. And by 5 years old, the brain is 90% of its adult weight. So these are some reasons that I get interested in how we can work with very young children. Here's what happens to neural density with age. You can see here that a newborn, the density of neurons increases until about 2 years, and then it starts to decrease after that. So we actually have the greatest neural density at 2 years old. So here's another question for you. Synapses, these are the connections between the neurons. This is what learning is. When we learn something, we strengthen the synaptical connections. How many are formed at age 2? 200? 20,000? Or 2 million? How many think A? How many think B? How many think C? The C's have it. So at 2 years old, a child is forming 2 million neural connections per second. Think of that. Think about the amount of learning that is happening in that child, the potential. So, with that, I'd like to just finish up with one last slide here, and this has to do with the informal education. So this is the 95% of our time that is not spent in the classroom during our life. So 5% of our life is spent in the classroom, 95% is spent outside the classroom. John Falk here is a colleague at Oregon State University until recently. He spent his whole life studying informal education, and his feeling now is that we should be spending a lot more time figuring out how to educate people in that out-of-classroom time, because that's where most of us spend most of our time. So with that, I would like to move it on to the discussion section. Now, we have two mics here. There's one. And we have another one. Do we have a volunteer who could take this one, I guess, if we need it? I would like to frame this discussion with one simple question, and that is, how can education change? How can education transform itself to better prepare people to address the climate change issue? So, it's open to you. Who would like to kick it off? Right here.
Thank you. This is very, very important. But I'd like to register a comment. I think we're underplaying education a little bit. Most of the talk here, you introduced informal education at the end. Most of the talk has been about school and university kinds of education, which are very, very important, and I agree with a lot of it. But we're missing a little bit of the importance of adult education here, I think. I'm reminded of John Kennedy, President Kennedy, when the group came in to convince him of the critical, you know, importance of civil rights and the passing legislation for civil rights, and his response was, fine, you've convinced me, now go out there and make me do it. In other words, it's fine, it depends on the political, I mean, this is maybe what was going to be talked about at 4 o'clock in this session on civic engagement, but I think there ought to be a real connection between the talk here about education, the talk about civic education, and what it takes to change people's minds enough out there in the public. You know, they may not have as many neural synapses firing at the age of 30 and 40, and yet what they think and how they operate is very, very important. And I think the lesson from a lot of social work there and political advocacy is that you want to rotate you're going to get everyone over into understanding it entirely, but rotate the spectrum of positions and understandings enough so that the center of gravity moves towards where it needs to go. So the very importance of adult education and all this, and in that realm one talks about not just formal education, informal education, and the other term is non-formal education, which is structured learning that goes on outside of school environments.
Thank you. Okay, you're next.
Me?
Go ahead.
Yeah. It seems to me that a lot of people I know who have graduate degrees in engineering or science deny the facts for global warming or climate change. And it seems to come from their identities to the political or social or religious groups that they're members of. It's part of a badge of being part of that group. And I don't know how you change that. It seems to me it would be very useful if that problem were studied in greater detail to see how you can change people's belief that they have to believe certain things to be part of a group, even if the facts contradict it, and they know it.
Very good point. Thank you. Can we have a mic down here? Take your pick.
Yeah, maybe relates somewhat to the last question, and it's a discussion that a few of us have had with Paul Stern off and on for quite a while. I like his list of things that need doing in a curricular sense, and the fact that the social sciences side of the equation has been underplayed for a long time, and it needs to be beefed up. I couldn't agree with him more. But in a curricular setting, in a broad educational setting like Amherst, there still remains, I think, a role for, call it the hard sciences, if you will, if for no other reason than to clarify, shrink, and reduce the sorts of scientific error bars that Phil Allen referred to. That's not going to solve the problem. That's not going to get the policy changed overnight, but it is going to reduce the maneuver room for the denialists that are still out and about, even in the scientific and educated community. Yeah, it's true that at Amherst you really have to look hard to find somebody who's a denialist, but out there in the broad world, they're still out and about. And a way, not the only way, but a way is still through the hard sciences of observation, physics, chemistry, you name it, to try to understand better the sources of error in the climate projections that we have. They're good, but they're not perfect, and there's plenty of error bars, and any climate scientist worth his or her salt would tell you that. And there are scientific questions to be addressed, research questions to knock those error bars down, make better projections. We've done it for weather forecasting. We need to do it for climate forecasting. and thereby reduce the amount of maneuver room for the kind of it's all baloney response that's still out and about.
Oh, it works. Thanks. So my question is more on the emotional spectrum. And for those at Amherst, I'm curious in terms of hope to despair, where would you gauge the current students? And then Charles, back to early development, when does hope enter into development? Those kinds of things like being hope or despair or anxiety come in at what age?
Go for it.
I think I'm even just in the 5 years that I've been here, I'm seeing more students. I mean, I think you can just look in the news and see that students are, young people are starting to really take action out of despair. I interact more directly with students than my supervisor does, and I told him once when we were talking about the Common Action Plan, I said, you know what, I've heard students say they are really thinking seriously about whether they want to have children. And that's a really hard thing to hear. I mean, I have a 2.5-year-old, which I now think I need to plan some really important educational activities with this weekend. Our students, I mean, our 18 to 21-year-olds, they're really thinking this. And so I think a challenge for me and for my colleagues here is to turn that into, make sure that we're helping them turn that into hope and not have it be just despair. Sometimes despair drives action, but I think we really need hope to drive the actions that we actually need to see in the long term.
Is it on?
Just start talking and I think they'll turn it on.
Hello, can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, so I think before I read this book a few weeks ago, I would have considered myself amongst the optimistic, slightly technocratic, that we're going to come up with a scientific, ways to somehow mitigate some of climate change. But I think I have leaned more and more into despair, and I think it's really important for me and others to find ways out of that, because I have twin 11-year-old girls, and they are being taught about this in school right now, and they're watching the PBS NewsHour with me as we watch things unfurl, and I'm looking for that sense of optimism again, and it's a little bit hard to find at times.
Let me say a word here. There's so much to talk about, but hope and despair are both out there. Can you hear me? Yeah, okay. I think really the big question, setting aside the emotional part of it, is how do you optimize your actions? You know, they're trying to do something to limit climate change. I would prioritize ahead of trying to do something to adapt to it, because adaptations are local and focused, and limiting reduces the risk for everybody. There are things to be done for all of the sciences and arts and humanities, and the physical sciences in terms of optimizing action. One of the interesting things that I've seen in recent years is the application of what they call life cycle analysis, that says if you look at human needs and wants like shelter and mobility and food, and you look at the life cycle producing those things, from extraction of raw materials to manufacturing to distribution to sales, consumption, use, disposal. And you say, what are the carbon emissions from each phase of meeting those human needs and wants? This can help you prioritize what to focus on. You know, what are the areas that are important? And, you know, I've done a lot of work over the years looking at household energy consumption, and that's important. And that's visible in a sense, because it has direct effects when you heat your home with oil or natural gas. They're pretty direct. You know, on the other hand, you know, what's even more visible are how you operate your lights and where you set your thermostats, which has less effect than the equipment that you have in the first place. On the other hand, if you look at the food system, the impacts of food choices are much less visible. But if you go through a life cycle analysis and you look at the extraction of raw materials and fertilizers to grow crops, to feed animals, to feed people, there's a lot of greenhouse gas emissions upstream in the life cycle that consumers don't recognize. And it turns out, you know, and I've recently realized looking at some of the literature, you know, that if you look at things that households can do immediately, eating less beef is a big one. You know, it hadn't occurred to me when I was looking at household energy consumption. But it's not because of eating beef, it's because of the, you know, what you do when you cook the food. It's up the stream. And, you know, these are scientific questions for the physical and biological sciences that inform the kind of work that I'm interested in, you know, which is, well, how do you optimize your focus? And then how do you make things happen? You know, which is the economic, political, social science, behavioral science side of it. You know, which is one of the reasons that I'm saying it's really a liberal arts challenge in a place like Amherst that has students who talk to each other, who take courses in a lot of different fields. You know, if you can organize efforts to try to integrate across those fields and say, what can we do effectively to make change? You know, Amherst is a place that can help make that happen.
Okay, so I'd like to answer two questions. First, I'd like to answer your question that you asked earlier about the error bars to this little demonstration here. And that's a lower bound. Okay, so it's based on, first of all, climate change that's happened between the Industrial Revolution and now, taking that amount of temperature change, and we know that that's accelerating. It's for the area, it's taking the central part of the continental United States as the area and the current profile of temperature. So that's what I would say. It's, if anything, it's going to be faster than that in reality. But of course, it varies from place to place because there's, you know, the climate is not you know, homogeneous across the entire lower 48 states. Does that answer your question?
The question really is how much is
science and the kind of analysis of error bars, how useful is that in getting people to change the way things are happening?
Oh, that's another question. And I'm going to refer that one to Paul in a minute, okay? But it's a very important question. It's at the root of what we're talking about here.
I can explain to people who are well-educated, I can explain to them why carbon dioxide is different from the other gases. Should I try to do that? Is that useful? I could get my daughter, who's a film producer, to help me produce something if I could get some collaborators, but I don't know if it's useful.
Yeah. Well, I'll try to say a little bit about that. I think one of the values of the physical science and also the biological science is to get people to pay attention to the issue. And once you get people to pay attention to the issue, then they start asking themselves, what can you do about it? And if they're not totally in despair, they say, what can you do about it? You know, and that's where all of the sciences have something to say to help you prioritize your efforts and to think about, you know, where I am, where I can have influence, what are the most useful things that I can do? You know, so this is where I was getting into with all the social roles. What can I do as a consumer? What can I do as a citizen? What can I do as a worker in a company? What can I do as an investor? You know, and a colleague in mine did a paper about 20 years ago addressed at households and energy use, saying it's called the short list. You know, here are some things that you can do that have high impact. Which ones apply to you? Look through this list of things that potentially have a high impact and ask yourself, which ones can you do? And focus on those. You know, so I think the physical sciences that have demonstrated that anthropogenic climate change is happening, is increasing, it has long lag times and all of that stuff, gets the attention of a lot of us. And then the question is, what do you do once you're paying attention?
Okay. And I let me quickly answer the other question here. You asked about how early do we need to start to get people to think about these things, or to... Yeah. Well, I haven't studied that in particular, but I do want to just mention one thing, is that we are learning in developmental psychology, we are learning that children are capable of a lot more than we thought they were. And there's a very interesting study on what's called theory of mind. I won't go into detail about that, but it has to do with children's ability to understand other points of view and other people. And we have now documented very, very clearly that that develops between 14 and 18 months. So think about it. Okay, we have more questions here.
Not much time.
One thing that has quite frustrated a number of us is that we now have a fearless leader of our government who totally rejects the whole idea of climate change. This is disastrous, and it's disastrous to me personally, and it should be. We're being very nice in our conversation, but I hate to say it. I think this person should be driven out of government. Thank you.
Right behind you. Okay, you're next.
Hey, Charlie. In your example of the two generations from your uncle's birth until now, you know, and then the climate has moved 200 miles. That didn't happen in a linear progression with 2 miles every year. How much of that, you know, it's dramatically back-end loaded. Do you have some feel for, I mean, was 180 miles of that done in the last 20 years, or?
It's averaged over the last century and a half, basically. Yeah, that's an average over the last century and a half, you can say. Well, I can't give you the exact shape, but it is accelerating. Wait a minute, this woman in the back here has been waiting.
Thank you. I want to loop back to the conversation around hope and despair for a moment. There was something that I was thinking about as some of those issues were raised, social aspects. I love that this is framed within, like, what can a liberal arts education do for this topic? And I fully believe we need all pieces. And I just wanted to put in a plug for a number of different authors that I've personally found incredibly good at speaking to this. One is Rob Hopkins, who wrote the Transition Town Handbook. It's a very practical handbook about how to create more resilient communities based on a permaculture model. And what I love about how he talks about that is he says we need both the hands and the heart. We need both the very practical applications, the people who know how to do certain things that will help reduce energy consumption, plant trees, etc., the scientists, and we need the heart. We need the artists and the counselors and the people that have spiritual ways of looking at this issue. The other thing I wanted to say is that I'm a mother of a 14 and a 16-year-old, and they've grown up with this kind of education, and I see a lot of despair. And what I really want to make a plug for is that every educator who's dealing with environmental studies and educating young people about climate change, that they think about how to integrate real conversation around hope and despair. And I want to make a plug for the work of Joanna Macy. She's an incredible woman who's written a book called Active Hope, and she dares to go into that very scary conversation that says, okay, you know the facts, but how do you feel about it? And to get people to talk about that, to get children to talk about that. So if anybody has more questions, I don't want to take up too much time, but I know some incredible groups in my state of Maine that are having that conversation with young people, and I'd love to share more. And I've trained as a transition town facilitator, so I can share more about that as well. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now, we have about 1 minute left, so we got one last question here, and then we'll have to wrap because the room needs to be... prepared for the next event.
Yeah, more of a comment than a question. I think 2 points. First, I think that we've got this duality between hope and despair going on, and I think it's much more nuanced than that. I think that there's the hope that things will be the way they used to be, and I can go out and eat a ribeye on 4th of July, and there's the hope that at least I'll be alive and happy and able to live in some fashion, and I think that we got to distinguish between what we're hoping for so that we're not out there hoping for things that are unrealistic and trying to develop solutions that are unrealistic, and thus we solve the despair problem. The other thing, to the point of activism, I've been very involved in an outfit called Extinction Rebellion, which has gotten a lot of press in the UK, and I would use that as a template for some of the things that your students may be considering.
Thank you. Well, we have come to the end of our hour. I want to thank everybody again for coming and joining us. I will point out that as you go out the back, there's a gentleman in a purple shirt who has some things to hand out for you, including a little list of all the other climate-related programs that are taking place at Reunion this weekend.
And if you haven't seen it, a sign-up sheet to be on a list served to
yes.
continue the conversation.
Okay. So do you want to say that again, Paul, just in seconds?
He also has a sign-up sheet to be on a list serve if you want to continue the conversation about what Amherst can do to help limit climate change.
So let's have a big round of applause for our panel here.